fat piece of shit. Do you have any idea what that does? Yes, I said in a shaking voice and lifted the viewfinder to my eye. Yes, I do. Say cheese. 9. There are a lot of things I don't understand about that night. I took photo after photo of him. The Solarid pictures fell, one after another, into a pile at my feet. A standard Polaroid cartridge contained 12 pictures. The extra-large cartridges allowed you to take 18 photographs. But the Solarid never needed to be reloaded, and it never ran out. He didn't come get me. The first picture dazed him, just as it had dazed Matt. It seemed to put him back on his high Cuban heels, his eyes blank, staring far away at some distant view he would never see again. He stood there, fixed in place, a computer trying to boot up. But he could never get unstuck because I kept firing the camera at him. After the first dozen photos, he did finally move, but not to charge me. Instead, he carefully, almost daintily, crossed his ankles and then slid to the floor to sit like a disciple meditating in an ashram. After another 20 snapshots, he began to tilt over to one side. 10 pictures later, he was curled in the fetal position on the floor. In all this time, a sly, subtle, knowing smile remained on his face. But at a certain point, one corner of his mouth began to glisten with drool. Shelley stirred from the narcotic fog created by the Solarid and was able to sit up, blinking sleepily. Her hair floated in bluish tangles around her shriveled dumpling face.
"Who's that?"
she asked, looking at the Phoenician. "I don't know," I said, and took another picture.
"Is it Alamagusalem? My father says Alamagusalem lives in the walls and drinks tears."
"No," I said, "but maybe they're related." I don't think the Phoenician drank tears, but I believe he enjoyed seeing them quite a bit. Maybe 50 photos in, the Phoenician's eyelids sank halfway shut and his eyes rolled back to show the whites, and he began to shiver. His breath shot out of him in short, harsh bursts. I lowered the camera, scared he was going to have a seizure. I regarded him carefully, and after a minute, the tremors began to subside. He was ragdoll limp, and his face had assumed an expression of forlorn imbecility. It was perhaps like electroshock therapy. You could fry the brain for only so long before you risked overloading the system and stopping the heart. I decided to give him a chance to get his breath back. I bent and grabbed a fistful of the pictures on the floor. I knew it would be a mistake to look at them, but I looked anyway. I saw a crying man, mid-50s, on his knees in a gravel driveway, fleshy and naked and holding out a pair of car keys in a desperate offering. He was cut all over, lots of fine red slashes trickling blood. The big white caddy, the one the Phoenician went around in, could be seen in the background, parked under a willow, so shiny and clean it might have just rolled out of a 1950s-era magazine ad. A snapshot of a reflection in the caddy's driver's side mirror. Dust rolling over a dirt drive, partially obscuring a naked man, face down in the road with what looked like a garden trowel in the small of his back. I could not tell you why this picture was so joyous, so carefree. Some quality of the late spring light. Some sense of escape, of effortless motion. A child, a girl, in a winter cap with ear flaps, clutching a lollipop of enormous size. She smiled uncertainly for the photographer. A Paddington bear peeked out from under one arm, where she held it clutched against her side. The same child in a coffin, her plump hands folded on the velvet bodice of her gown, her face smooth and untroubled by dreams. A scarf the color of darkest wine had been arranged artfully around her throat. Paddington Bear was under the same arm, peering out in much the same way. A gaunt hand reached into the frame, as if perhaps to push a curl of yellow hair back from the girl's brow. a basement. The background was a wall of old whitewashed brick with a narrow cobwebbed window set 6 feet above the floor. Someone had crudely drawn black marks in what I am sure was Phoenician script just below the window. Three rings of ash, slightly overlapping one another, had been sketched on the cement. In the one farthest to the left was a circle of smashed mirror. In the one farthest to the right was a Paddington Bear. In the central circle was a Polaroid camera. Old people and more old people. There had to be at least a dozen. A scrawny old man with an oxygen tube in his nose. A baggy old hobbit of a fellow with a peeling sunburned nose. A dazed-looking fat woman, one corner of her mouth twisted in the snarl of someone who has suffered a severe stroke. And, finally, me, Michael Figlioni, standing beside Shelley's bed, an expression of sick terror on my moon-shaped face, the Solarid in my hands, the flash igniting. It was the last thing he'd seen before I started shooting. I collected the slippery squares into a stack and put them in the deep pockets of the fluffy white robe. The Phoenician had rolled back onto his side. Some clarity had returned to his eyes, and he watched me with a foolish look of fascination. He had wet himself, a dark stain soaking his crotch and down his thighs. I don't think he knew. "Can you get up?" I asked. "Why?" "Because it's time to leave."
"Oh."
He didn't move, though, until I bent and took his shoulder and told him to stand. Then he did, docile and bewildered.
"I think I'm lost," he said. "Do we know each other?"
He spoke in little bursts that suggested he was having trouble finding the right words. "No," I said firmly. "Come on." I steered him down the hall and to the front door. I thought I had absorbed all the shocks the night had to offer, but there was one more waiting. We got as far as the front step, and then I caught in place. The yard and the street were littered with dead birds. Sparrows, I think. There had to be almost 1,000 of them. Stiff little black rags of feathers and claws and BB pellet eyes. And the grass was full of fine glassy pebbles. They crunched underfoot as I walked down the steps. Hail. I sank to one knee, my legs were weak, and looked at one of the dead birds. I poked it with a nervous finger and discovered that it was flash frozen, as stiff and cold and hard as if it had just been pulled out of an icebox. I rose again and looked down the street. The feathered dead went on and on for as far as the eye could see. The Phoenician rocked on his heels, brainlessly surveying the carnage. Shelley stood behind him, just inside the open front door, a far more serene expression on her face. "Where'd you park your car?" I asked him.
"Park?"
he said. His hand had dropped to the front of his trousers.
"I'm wet."
He didn't say it like it bothered him. The Thunderheads had blown off to the east, coming apart into mountainous islands. The sky to the west was a bright, burning gold, darkening to a deep red along the horizon. A hideous shade, the color of the human heart. It was a hideous hour. I left him in the yard and went looking for his car. "Are you surprised by that? That I left the Phoenician alone in the yard with Shelley Bukes, just walked away from the both of them?" "It never crossed my mind to worry." By then I understood the stunning effect of exposure to the solar had multiplied each time the camera went off. After zapping him more than 50 times, I had just about lobotomized him. Temporarily, anyway. Even now a part of me thinks I did enough damage inside his head to leave him permanently impaired. Certainly Shelley never recovered. You knew that, didn't you? If you were hoping somehow that that kind, brave old woman was going to get it all back in the end, then this story is going to disappoint you. Not one of those birds got up and flew away, and not a bit of what she lost was ever returned to her. Almost as soon as I was walking up the street, I began to cry. Not out-and-out racking sobs, just a weak, miserable trickle of tears and a hitching of breath. At first I tried not to step on any of the dead birds, but after a couple hundred feet I gave up. There were too many of them. They made muffled snapping sounds underfoot. The temperature had dropped while I was inside, but it had started climbing again, and when I found the Phoenician's caddy, steam was rising from the wet blacktop surrounding it. He hadn't parked far away, just along the curb around the corner where the development hadn't really developed yet. There were ranch houses along one side of the road, pretty spread out, but a dense wall of forest and scrub brush on the other. A good place to leave a car for a while if you didn't want anyone to notice. When I returned to the Bukes' house, the Phoenician had sat down on the curb. He was holding a dead bird by one scaly leg and inspecting it closely. Shelley had found a broom and was futilely sweeping the lawn, trying to collect up the little corpses. "Come on," I said to him, "let's go." The Phoenician put the dead bird in his shirt pocket and obediently stood. I walked him down the path, up the street, and around the corner. I didn't notice Shelley following us with her broom until we were almost to the Phoenician's big caddy. I opened the car door, and after a moment of staring blankly into the front seat, the Phoenician slid behind the wheel. He looked at me hopefully, waiting for me to tell him what to do next. Did he still remember how to drive? I wondered. I leaned in to pat his pant pockets for his keys, and that's when I caught an eye-watering reek of gasoline. I glanced into the back and saw a red fuel can sitting on the rear seats next to the stack of photo albums. I knew then what it would ultimately take arson investigators another 3 weeks to determine, that the fire at Mr. Bukes' Cupertino gym had been caused not by a stroke of lightning, but by a stroke of malice. The power outage in the neighborhood, on the other hand, was really just a byproduct of the storm. I'm less sure that the storm itself was a purely natural event. An hour earlier, I had considered the possibility that the Phoenician might have some occult influence over the weather and rejected the idea with a certain amused disgust. But the notion seemed less absurd as I looked out upon those acres of slaughtered birds. Did he have a hand in the storm after all? Perhaps. Perhaps not. I said there was a lot about that evening I don't understand. I imagined reaching into the back of the caddy and sprinkling what little was left in the can on the Phoenician, then dropping the car lighter in his lap. But of course I wasn't going to do that. I felt sick about stepping on a dead sparrow. I was hardly going to murder a living man. I left the gas can where it was, but on impulse I grabbed the topmost photo album and stuck it under my arm. I discovered the keys in the dashboard ashtray and started the caddy for him. The Phoenician gazed at me devoutly. "You can go now," I said.
"Go where?"
"I don't care, as long as it's nowhere near here." He nodded slowly, and then a sweet, dreamy smile appeared on his leprous face.
"That Spanish gin will fuck you up, huh? I should have stopped at one. I got a feeling I'm not going to remember any of this tomorrow morning."
"Maybe I ought to take your picture," Shelley said from behind me, "so you don't forget."
"Hey," he said,
"that's a good idea." "Smile real big, bucko," Shelley said.
And he did, and she thudded him in the teeth with the handle of her broom. It made a bony thwack and snapped his head to the side. She cackled. When he looked up, his hand was clapped over his mouth, but there was blood dribbling between his fingers. His eyes were childlike and frightened.
"You want to keep that crazy bitch away from me," he cried. "Hey, bitch, you better watch out. I know some real bad men."
"Not anymore," I said, and slammed the car door in his face. He banged down the lock and stared at us with a mute terror. His hand fell away from his mouth to show blood in his teeth, and a swiftly fattening upper lip twisted in a painful sneer. I didn't wait to see him take off. I gripped Shelley by the shoulder and turned her around and started back. We were almost to the yard when he drove by. He hadn't forgotten how to steer his big caddy after all, And looking back from my more informed adult perspective, I'm not surprised. Motor memory is compartmentalized, set aside from other thought processes. Many people, lost entirely in the blinding white fog of senility, can still flawlessly perform certain piano pieces they learned as children. What the mind forgets, the hands remember. The Phoenician didn't so much as glance at us. Instead, he was bent forward over the steering wheel, looking this way and that, his eyes shiny with anxiety. I had seen the exact same look on Shelley's face earlier in the day, when she was desperately scanning the neighborhood for something, anything, that might seem familiar. At the end of the street, he struck his blinker, turned right for the highway, and drove out of my life. 10. When I pulled the sheets over her, Shelley gave me a sleepy smile and reached out to grasp my hand.
Do you know how many times I tucked you in, Michael? Lives have bookends, but you have to keep your eyes peeled if you want to see him, bucko.
I bent and kissed her temple, which had the soft, powdery texture of ancient vellum. She never said my name again, although there were days when I'm sure she remembered me. There were more days when she didn't, but now and then her eyes would flash with recognition, and I'm certain she knew me at the end. Not a doubt in my mind. 11. Mr. Bukes didn't get home until 2 a.m., time enough for me to straighten up and put my clothes through the dryer, time enough to rake up the dead birds in the yard, time enough to pour a glass of strawberry quick. Mr. Bukes liked to use it as an ingredient in his protein shakes, and I like to use it as an ingredient in my fat ass, and take stock. Time to leaf through the stolen photo album, the one marked S. Bukes in black Sharpie on the inside cover. It could have been anyone's collection of memories, although the oldest Polaroids in the book showed scenes that had occurred well before color photography was available to the masses, and so many snapshots were of things no one would have photographed. Here was a wooden horse on wooden wheels, with a rope strung through a hole in its head being pulled along a concrete sidewalk. Here was a sunlit blue sky with a single cloud in it, a cloud shaped like a cat, tail curled in a question mark shape. The chubby hands of a toddler reached up toward it from the bottom edge of the photograph. Here was a brawny woman with big crooked teeth peeling a potato at a sink, a radio in a walnut case glowing on the kitchen counter in the background. Based on the resemblance, I guessed it was Shelley's mother and that the year might be somewhere around 1940. Here was a 20-year-old knockout with the body of an Olympic swimmer wearing white underwear, her arms crossed over her bare chest, a fedora perched on her head. She inspected herself in a full-length mirror. A big mule of a man, completely naked, could be seen in the reflection as well, sitting on the edge of a mattress. He grinned wolfishly and studied her with frank admiration. I had to look at this image for half a minute before it sank in that the girl was Shelley herself and the man behind her was her future husband. Midway through the book, I came across a series of four Polaroids that gave me a very nasty shock, four snapshots I cannot explain. It was the girl again, the girl with the Paddington Bear, the dead girl I'd seen in the Phoenicians' mind photographs. Photographs? They had both known her. In these images, it was the late 60s, early 70s. In one, the girl sat on a kitchen counter, her cheeks wet with tears, a scrape on one knee. She bravely clutched her bear to her chest as Shelley's big, freckled hands reached into frame with a Band-Aid. In another Polaroid, Shelley's strong, confident fingers worked a sewing needle, stitching Paddington Bear's hat back on his head, while the girl looked on with dark, grave eyes. In the third picture, the child slept on a rich girl's bed, surrounded by stuffed bears, but it was Paddington she clutched tight to her chest in sleep. In the last photograph, the little girl was dead at the bottom of the world's steepest stone staircase, face down in a spreading puddle of blood, one arm flung out as if reaching back for Paddington, who had wound up only about halfway down the steps. I don't know who she was. Not Shelley's daughter. Someone she'd looked after when she was younger, a first nannying job. That steep stone staircase didn't look like Cupertino. San Francisco, maybe. I can't be sure how the girl with the bear connected Shelley and the Phoenician. I've said there's a lot I don't understand, but I have my ideas. I think the Phoenician was trying to erase himself. That he was visiting people who knew him or might have known him before he was the Phoenician. I think every photo album in his car belonged to someone who might have remembered the man or boy he'd been before his body became a profane manuscript in a tongue that has been perhaps rightfully forgotten. As to why he needed to scrub that former version of himself from living memory, I will not hazard a guess. The last pages of Shelley's memory album were the hardest to look at. You know what was in them. There I was, sitting on a concrete step, placidly allowing Shelley to tie my shoes with worn, age-freckled hands that were so much older than the hands that appeared in the Paddington Bear photos. I sat in her lap while she read me Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, a plump 7-year-old version of me, with hopeful eyes underneath tousled bangs, held up a green and golden frog, no bigger than a quarter, for her inspection and approval. It should have been my mother's arms around me, and my father reading to me. But it wasn't. It was Shelley. Again and again, it was Shelley Bukes, loving, cherishing, a lonely fat boy who desperately needed someone to notice him. My mother didn't want the job, and my father didn't really know how to do it, so it fell to Shelley. And she adored me with all the enthusiasm of a woman who's just won a new car on The Price is Right. Like she was the lucky one. To have me. To have the good fortune to bake me cookies and fold my underwear and endure my grade school tantrums and kiss my boo-boos. When really, I was the lucky one. And never knew it. 12. In the year and a half that followed, Shelley had two kinds of days. Bad and worse. Mr. Bukes and I tried to look after her. She forgot how to use a knife and we had to cut her food for her. She forgot how to use the toilet and we changed her diapers. She forgot who Larry was and was sometimes frightened of him when he walked into the room. She was never frightened of me, but she often didn't know who I was. Although, maybe there was a little tickle of a memory back there somewhere, because often when I walked into the house, she would shout, "Daddy, the repairman is here to fix the TV." Sometimes when Larry wasn't around, I sat with her and looked at the Phoenician's album of stolen memories, trying to get her interested in those thoughtographs with their muddy colors and bad lighting. But usually she would sulk and turn her head away so she didn't have to see them and say something like, "Why are you showing me this? Go fix the TV. Mickey Mouse Club is on next. I don't want to miss anything good." Only once did I see her respond to an image in the photo album. One afternoon, she looked at the picture of the dead girl at the bottom of the steps with sudden, childlike fascination. She pressed her thumb to the photograph and said, "Pushed." "Yes, Shelley? Was she? Did you see who did it?" "Disappeared," she said, and sprayed her fingers out in a theatrical poof gesture. "Like a ghost. Are you going to fix the TV?" "You bet," I promised. "Mickey Mouse Club, coming up." In the fall of my sophomore year in high school, Larry Bukes dozed off in front of the TV, and Shelley wandered out of the house. She was not found until 4 o'clock the next morning. Two cops discovered her 3 miles away looking for something to eat in a dumpster behind the Dairy Queen. Her feet were black with filth, ragged and bloody, and her fingernails were broken, her fingers raw, as if she'd fallen into a gully and had to claw her way out. Someone had helped himself to her wedding and engagement rings. She didn't know Larry when he came to get her. She didn't respond to her own name. She couldn't say where she'd been and didn't care where she was going, as long as there was TV. I came by to see her the next afternoon, and Larry answered the door in a baggy Mexico t-shirt and his boxers, his silver hair standing up on one side of his head. When I asked if I could help with Shelley, his face shriveled and his chin began to quake.
Hector took her away. He took her while I was asleep.
Dad, shouted a voice from somewhere behind him.
Dad, who are you talking to?
Larry ignored him and came down the step into the light.
What must you think of me? I let Hector take her away. I signed all the papers. I did as I was told because I was tired and she was too much trouble. Do you believe she would have ever given me up?
And he took me in his arms and began to sob.
Dad!
Hector shouted again, coming to the door. There he was, the bodybuilder and Navy boy, proud owner of a mint 82 Trans Am straight out of Knight Rider, the son I only sometimes remembered that Shelley and Larry had, the kid who made a party trick of picking up a chair one-handed while his mother sat in it. He had put on a spare tire of fat, and the ink on his Sailor Jerry tattoo had begun to blur and fade. His fashion sense hadn't matured in the years he'd been away, and might best be described as Richard Simmons chic. He wore a bright red sweatband to hold his frizzy hair out of his eyes, and a tank top with a pirate on it. He looked embarrassed.
Jesus, Dad, come on. You're gonna make the kid feel awful. It isn't like you sent it to the pound. You can see her every day. We both can. It was best for her. You're putting yourself in an early grave chasing after her. You think that's what she'd want? Come on. Come on now.
He put an enormous arm over his dad's shoulder and gently peeled Larry off me. As he turned his father back into the house, he flashed a chagrined smile and said, "Come on in, bucko. I just made date cookies." When he called me bucko, I shivered. Shelley had been admitted to a place called Bellaver House. Hector had driven her there that morning while his father was napping. It wasn't the Four Seasons, but she'd get her pills on time and wouldn't be digging in a Dairy Queen dumpster for edibles. Hector said his father had been crying ever since. He told me this after Larry Bukes had shuffled back to bed, where he'd spent almost the entire day. By then, Hector and I were sitting in front of the People's Court with tea and warm date cookies, their insides sweet and gluey, bits of walnut in them to give a little crunch. Hector leaned forward over his plate to speak to me in a confidential tone that was entirely unnecessary since we were all alone. I used to be kind of jealous of you, you know. The way my mom talked about you, the way you did everything right, good grades, never talking back. I'd come off from Tokyo to tell her I just ate sushi with a relative of the emperor, and she'd say, "Oh, great. By the way, Bucko just invented a working nuclear reactor out of spare Legos and rubber bands." He shook his head, grinning beneath his Tom Selleck mustache. "She was right about you, though. You were every bit the stand-up kid she said you were. If not for you, I don't know how my dad would have managed the last year and a half. And Ma, back before it all slipped away from her, you gave her a reason to get up every morning. You made her laugh. You made her a lot happier than I ever did, I guess." I was mortified. I didn't know what to say. I fixed my gaze on the TV, and with my mouth half full, I said, "Great cookies, just like your mom used to make them." He nodded wearily. "Yeah, I found the recipe in one of her notebooks. You know what she called them? Date cookies?" "Mike's favorite," he said. 13. I went to see her now and then over the next couple years. Sometimes I went with Larry, sometimes with Hector, who'd moved to San Francisco to be closer to his parents. Later, I drove myself. The first year or so, she was always glad to see me, even if she thought I was the TV repairman. But by the time I was a senior in high school, she no longer acknowledged me when I visited, or anyone else. She sat in front of the TV in the overcrowded common room, a sunlit space that smelled of urine and old people and dust, a place with dirty tile floors and fraying second-hand furniture. Her head lolled forward on her neck, the folds of her chin sunk into her chest. Sometimes she would whisper to herself, "Next channel, next, next, next." She got very excited whenever someone changed the channel, would bob up and down in her seat for a couple moments before settling back into her melted slouch. Maybe a month before I left for MIT, I drove into San Francisco for a meeting with the homebrew computer hobbyists. And on the way back, I got off the interstate two exits early and swung by Bellever to look in on Shelley. She wasn't in her room, and the nurse at the desk couldn't tell me where to find her if she wasn't in front of the TV. I discovered her sitting in a wheelchair by some vending machines in a side hallway, down the corridor from her bedroom, unattended and forgotten. It had been a while since Shelley even seemed to notice me, let alone recognize me. But when I knelt next to her, something, some dim awareness, brightened in those green eyes of hers that had gone as soft and faded as sea glass.
"Bucko,"
she whispered. Her gaze shifted away and came back again.
"Hate this. Wish I could forget how to breathe."
And then that faint, almost amused light flickered in her eyes.
"Hey, what'd you do with that camera? Wouldn't you like to take my picture? Something to remember your best girl by?"
My whole back went as goosebumpy and cold as if someone had dumped a bucket of ice water on me. I leapt away from her, then went around behind her and grabbed the handles of her chair and rolled her out into the hall, rumbled her briskly on to the lobby. I didn't want to know what she meant. I didn't want to think about it. I cornered the nurse behind the desk and made ugly noises at her. I said I wanted to know who had left my mother by a fucking vending machine and how long she'd been there and how much longer she would have been there if I hadn't randomly stopped by. When I spoke of her as my mother, I had no sense that this was in any way a lie. And it felt good to be angry. It was a sorry second to being loved, but it was better than nothing. I yelled until the nurse was flushed and looked stricken and shamed. It satisfied me to see her dab at her eyes with a tissue, to see the way her hands shook when she picked up the phone to call her supervisor. And while I vented, Shelley sat in her wheelchair, head lolling on her chest, as forgotten and invisible as she'd been by the vending machines. How easily we forget. 14. That night, a hot wind. It was like air blowing from an open furnace, tore through Cupertino, and thunder banged, but no rain fell. When I went out to my car in the morning, I found a dead bird on the hood. The gale had flung a sparrow into the windshield hard enough to snap its neck. 15. My dad asked if I planned to visit Shelley before I left for Massachusetts. I said I thought I would. 16. The Solarid was in a box in my bedroom closet, along with the photo album of Shelley's thoughts and a manila envelope containing the Phoenician's memories. What, did you think I threw any of that away? That I could have thrown any of it away? Once, a few weeks after I saw the last of the Phoenician, I got his not-a-camera down from the top shelf in my closet and brought it to the garage. Just touching it made me nervous. I remembered how, when Frodo put on the ring, he became visible to Sauron's infected red eye, and I was afraid that merely by coming in contact with the Solarid, I might somehow summon the Phoenician back. "Hey, Fatso, remember me? Yeah, you do? Not for long." But in the end, after turning it over and over in my hands, I put it back in the closet. I never did anything with it. I didn't take it apart. I couldn't see how to. There were no seams, no places where the plastic parts joined together. It was, impossibly, all of one piece. Perhaps if I took a picture, I might have learned something more, but I didn't dare. No, I shoved it back in the closet and then hid it behind a box of wires and circuit boards. After a month or two, I was sometimes even able to go 15 minutes without thinking about it. The weekend before I was set to depart for Boston, my dad and I were flying there together. I opened the closet and went looking for it. A part of me didn't expect it to be there, had almost come to believe that the Phoenician was someone I'd dreamed up in a day of fever and emotional distress years earlier. But the Solarid was there, just as I remembered it. Its blank, blind glass eye stared down at me from the top shelf, a mechanical cyclops. I set it gently in the back seat of my Honda Civic, so I wouldn't have to look at it while I drove to Bellever House. Just staring at it felt dangerous, like it might suddenly, vengefully go off and wipe my mind to punish me for letting it gather dust for 4 years. Shelley was in her bedroom, a compartment just a little larger than a prison cell. I knew that Hector and Larry had been by to see her a few hours before. They always dropped in on Saturday morning. I had timed my own visit to fall shortly after theirs, so they would have had a last chance to be with her. I found her in her wheelchair, turned to face the window. How I wish she'd had something beautiful to contemplate. A green park of oaks, a place with a fountain and benches and children. But her room looked out on a sun-baked parking lot and a pair of dumpsters. She had her Walkman in her lap, a pair of headphones on her head. Hector always put her headphones on when he left, so she could listen to the soundtrack of Stand By Me, the song she and Larry had danced to when he was new in the country and she was just out of high school. The music was long over, though, and she was just sitting there, her head twitching on her neck and spit hanging off her chin, sitting in a diaper that needed changing. I could smell it. Oh, the dignity of the silver years. I slipped off her headphones and eased the chair around to face the bed. I sat on the mattress across from her so our knees were almost touching.
"Birthday," Shelley said. She looked at me briefly, looked away. "Birthday. Whose birthday?"
"Yours," I said.
"It's your birthday, Shelley. Can I take your picture? Can I take some pictures of the birthday girl? And then we'll blow out the candles. We'll make a wish together and blow them all out."
Her gaze snapped back to me, and there was suddenly an almost avian interest in her eyes.
"Picture? Oh, okay, bucko."
I took her picture. The flash flashed. And again, and again, and again. Pictures fell to the floor and developed. Shelley's bent grandmother drawing a pan of date cookies from the oven, a cigarette poked in one corner of her mouth. A black and white TV set, children wearing Mickey Mouse ears, the name Bukes written in blurred black ink on a raised pink palm above a phone number. A fat baby with his fists raised in the air and jam smeared on his chin. Hector's hair, already a mess of fizzy curls. I shot a little more than 30 pictures, but the last three didn't develop, which is how I knew I was done. They were gray, toxic blanks, the color of thunderheads. By the time I rose, I was crying silently and furiously, a coppery taste in my mouth. Shelley slumped forward, her eyes open but seeing nothing. Her breathing was congested, hitching. Her lips were pursed as if she were about to blow out the candles on her birthday cake. I kissed her forehead, breathing deep the fragrance of the room where she'd spent the last years of her life. Dust, feces, rust, neglect. If I was wretched in that moment, it was not because I'd pointed the camera at her, but because I'd waited so long to do it. 17. Hector called the next day to let me know she had passed away at 2 in the morning. I didn't care what the cause of death was and didn't ask, but he told me anyway. "Her lungs just quit," he said. like her whole body suddenly forgot how to breathe. 18. After I hung up the phone, I sat in the kitchen listening to the clock on the oven tick, tick, tick. It was a very still morning, very hot. My dad was out, had the AM shift then. I went into my bedroom and got the Solarid. I wasn't scared to pick it up now. I carried it outside and put it down in the driveway, behind the front driver's side tire of my Civic. When I backed over it, I heard it shatter with a plasticky crunch. I put the Civic into park and got out to have a look. When I saw it, though, in the driveway, my heart leapt like a bird caught in a gale, thrown helplessly into the hard wall of my ribs. The case had been smashed into big, glossy splinters, but there was no machinery within. No gears, no ribbons, no electronics of any kind. Instead, it was filled with something that looked like tar. A thick gallon of black soup. A soup with an eye in it. A great yellow eye with a slit pupil at the center. A great blackberry-colored glob of Panama Thrill with an eyeball in it. As that tarry crap spread out in a puddle, I swear that single eye rolled to look at me. I wanted to scream. If I'd had enough air in my lungs, I would have. As I watched, though, the black liquid began to harden, rapidly turning silvery and pale. It stiffened at the edges, crinkling up, fossilizing. The shiny hardness spread inward, reaching that yellow eye at last and freezing it solid. When I picked it up, the whole black splash had become a blob of dull, lightweight steel, a little smaller than a manhole cover and about as thin as a dinner plate. It smelled like lightning, like hail, like dead birds. I held it for only a moment. That was all I could stand. No sooner had I picked it up than my head began to fill with hiss and static and lunatic whispering. My skull became an AM tuner dialing in a distant station, not radio adulthood, but radio madness. A voice that was ancient when Cyrus the Great crushed the Phoenician people under his heel whispered, "Michael, oh Michael, melt me down and build. Build one of your thinking machines. Build a computer, Michael, and I will teach you everything you want to know. I will answer every question, Michael. I will solve every riddle. I will make you rich. I will make women want to fuck you. I will." I flung it away with a kind of revulsion. The next time I picked it up, I used tongs to slide it into a garbage bag. Later that afternoon, I drove to the ocean and threw the fucking thing in. 19. Ha ha. Sure I did. 20. I did use tongs to handle it, and I did put it in a garbage bag. But I didn't throw it into the ocean. I threw it into the back of my closet, where I had kept the Solarid for so many years. That fall, my mother flew to America to meet my father and me in Cambridge and see me installed at MIT. I had not set eyes upon her for over a year, and was surprised to discover that her mouse-colored hair had gone completely silver and that she had taken to wearing rimless bifocals. We had a meal together as a family at Mr. Bartley's Gourmet Burgers on Mass Avenue, one of only a few meals I can recall us sharing together. My mother ordered shoestring onion rings and just picked at them. "What are you looking forward to the most?" my father asked me. My mom answered for me. "I imagine he's glad not to have to hide it anymore." "Hide what?" I asked. She pushed her shoestring onions away. "What he can do. Once you're in a place that lets you be your fullest self, well, you never want to leave." I have no memory of her ever saying she loved me, although she did give me a stiff hug around the neck at the airport and reminded me that contraception was my responsibility, not the responsibility of my future dates. She was killed in June of 1993 by members of the Lord's Resistance Army on a mountain road along the northwestern border of the Congo. She died with her French lover, the man with whom she had lived, it turned out, for most of a decade. Her death made the New York Times. My father absorbed the news the same way he'd responded to the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. Gravely, but with no great sign of personal grief. I could not tell you if they ever loved each other, or what led them to make a baby together. That is a mystery greater than anything concerning Shelley Bukes and the Phoenician. I will say that as far as I know, my father had no woman in his life in all the years when they were apart, first when they were separated by Africa, and later when they were divided by her death. And he read her books, every one. He kept them on the shelf right below the photo albums. My father lived to see me graduate from MIT and return to the West Coast to pursue my master's and then my PhD at Caltech. He died the week before I turned 22. A live subtransmission line let go on a wet and windy night and caught him across the back where he stood at the side of the repair van collecting his toolbox. He was nailed with 138 kilovolts. I went into the 21st century alone, an angry orphan who resented it whenever people my age bitched about their parents. My mom is pissed because I don't want to study law. My dad fell asleep at my graduation. Blah, blah, blah. But then I also resented people who didn't complain about their parents, but spoke of them with affection. My mom says she doesn't care what I do as long as I'm happy. My dad still calls me Little Trooper. Blah, blah, blah. There is no system of measurement that can adequately quantify how much resentment I carried in my heart when I was young and lonely. My sense of personal grievance ate me like cancer, hollowed me out, left me gaunt and wasted. When I set off for MIT at 18, I weighed 330 pounds. 6 years later, I was 170. It wasn't exercise, it was fury. Resentment is a form of starvation. Resentment is the hunger strike of the soul. I spent most of a musty, stultifying April vacation clearing out the house in Cupertino, boxing up clothes and shipped dinner plates to bring to Goodwill, delivering books to the library. That spring, the pollen was heavy, coating the windows with a bright yellow haze. Anyone who had come into the house would have found me with tears dripping off the end of my nose and assumed it was grief, when really it was allergies. Packing up the house where I'd lived out my entire childhood was a surprisingly dispassionate business. With our generic furniture sets and our inoffensive striped wallpaper, we had left almost no mark on the place at all. I had genuinely forgotten about the weird plate of steel shoved to the rear of my closet until I reached back there and put my hand on it. It was still in its garbage bag, but I could feel the bulges and planes of the metal through the plastic. I lifted it out and held the wrapped bundle in both hands for a long time, in a heavy, suspenseful silence, the sort of silence that settles on the world in the moments before a hard summer thunder shower breaks. That whispering iron never spoke to me again. Not in my waking thoughts, anyway. Sometimes it spoke to me in dreams, though. Sometimes in dreams I saw it as it had been when it first spilled out of the crushed Solarid, a tarry liquid with an eyeball in it, a weird thinking protoplasm that didn't belong in our reality. I had one dream in which I found myself sitting across the dinner table from my father. He was dressed for work, staring down into a bowl of purple Panama Thrill, the jello quivering and jiggling uneasily in its dish. "Aren't you going to have some dessert?" I asked. He looked up, and his eyes were yellow with cat's eye pupils. In a strained, unhappy voice, he said, "I can't. I think I'm going to be sick." And then he opened his mouth and began to vomit onto the table, gouts of that black goop coming out of him in a slow, sticky gush, bringing with it a hiss of static and a babble of madness. In my final years at Caltech, I began to develop the architecture for a new sort of memory system, crafting an integrated circuit board the size of a credit card. My prototype leaned heavily on components crafted out of that grotesque, impossible metal, and it achieved computational effects that I'm sure have never been matched, not in any lab, anywhere, by anyone. That first board was my Africa, was to me what the Congo had been to my mother, a splendid alien country where all the colors were brighter and where every new day of study promised some fresh, thrilling revelation. I lived there for years. I never wanted to come back. I had nothing to come back to. Not in those days. Then, the work was done. Ultimately, I found I could get impressive, if less remarkable, results by employing certain rare earth metals, ytterbium mostly, and cerium. It wasn't anything like what I could do with the whispering iron, but it still represented a major leap forward in the field. I was noticed by a company named after a crisp and juicy fruit, and signed a contract that made me a millionaire on the spot. If you have 3,000 songs and 1,000 photos on your phone, you're probably carrying some of my work in your pocket. I'm the reason your computer remembers everything you don't. No one has to forget anything anymore. I made sure of it. 21. Shelley has been gone for more than a quarter of a century now. I lost her, my mother, and my father before I turned 25. None of them saw me marry. None of them ever had a chance to meet my two boys. Every year, I give away as much money as my father earned in his entire lifetime, and I am still far richer than any man has any right to be. I have an indecent share of happiness. Although I confess, most of it only came after I was no longer mentally able to keep up with the latest breakthroughs in computer science. I am a professor emeritus at the company I signed with out of Caltech, which is a nice way of saying they only keep me around out of nostalgia. I haven't made a significant contribution to my field for over a decade. That weird, impossible alloy has long since been all used up. The same goes for me. Belliver House was demolished in 2005. There's a soccer pitch where it used to stand. The land beyond has been pleasantly groomed and planted, professionally landscaped into meadowy park with winding trails of white stone, a man-made pond, and a vast playground. I paid for most of it. I wish Shelley had lived to see the place. I am as haunted by her dying view of a parking lot and dumpsters as I am by my memories of the Phoenician. I don't like to think about her last days in that dismal little room. But I wouldn't erase those recollections even if I could. As awful as they are, those memories are me, and I would be less without them. We all went down to the park for the big opening, my wife and our two boys. It was August, and there was thunder in the morning, big, rolling cannonades of it. But come afternoon, the skies were stripped clean and blue, and you couldn't have wished for a better day. The town put on a good show. A 30-piece brass band played old-timey swing music in the bandstand. There was free face painting and one of those guys who makes animals out of balloons. And my old high school turned out the cheerleading troupe to do some jumping and tumbling and rah-rah-ing. What my boys liked most was a roaming magician, a guy with slicked back hair and waxed mustaches. He wore a purple tailcoat and a ruffled green blouse, and his great trick was making things disappear. He juggled burning torches, and somehow, as each one came down, it vanished as if it hadn't been. He held an egg in one hand and smashed his fist into it, and it was gone, shell and all. When he opened his fist, a chickadee sat chirping in his palm. He sat on a straight-backed chair and then collapsed into the dirt because the chair was gone. My boys, 6 and 4, knelt in the grass with dozens of other children, watching raptly. Me, I mostly watched the sparrows. There was a flock of them settled on the slope above the pond, picking contentedly. My wife took pictures with her phone, not a Polaroid. Tubas and trombones blatted in the dreamy distance. When I closed my eyes, the past seemed very close. Only the thinnest of membranes separating yesterday from today. I was close to dozing off when one of my sons, Boone, the younger boy, tugged on my shorts. The magician had walked behind a tree and dematerialized. The show was over.
"He's all gone," Boone cried in wonder. "You missed it."
"You can tell me about it. That will be just as good." The older boy, Neville, laughed scornfully.
"No, it won't. You should have kept watching."
"That's Daddy's magic trick. I can close my eyes and make the whole world disappear," I said. "Anyone want to see if we can make some ice cream vanish? I think there's a place selling soft serve on the other side of the pond." I got up and took Neville's hand. My wife took Boone's. We started away, crossing the greensward and startling the sparrows, which took off in one great rustling swoop.
"Dad," Boone said, "do you think we can always remember today? I don't want to forget the magic."
"Me neither," I said. "And I haven't yet."
Loaded. October 14, 1993. Aisha thought of him as her brother, even though they weren't blood. His name was Coulson, but his friends called him Romeo, because he had played that role in the park last summer, getting fresh with a white Juliet who had teeth so bright she should have been in a chewing gum ad. Aisha had watched him perform on a hot July evening, when dusk seemed to last for hours, a line of glowering red light on the horizon, the clouds, shavings of gold against the dark sky behind. Aisha was 10, and didn't understand half of what Coulson said up there on the stage, dressed in purple velvet like he was a prince. She couldn't follow the words, but she didn't have any problem making sense of the way Juliet looked at him. Aisha didn't have any problem figuring out why Juliet's cousin hated Romeo either. Tybalt didn't want some smooth-talking black kid crowding in on any white girl, let alone someone in his family. Now it was fall, and Aisha was getting ready for a performance of her own, the Holiday Vogue, which meant modern dance classes twice a week after school. Practice didn't end on Thursday nights until 6:30. And her mother wasn't there to collect her when it was done. Instead, Coulson showed up, 20 minutes late, after all the other girls had left, and Aisha was waiting alone on the stone steps. He looked good, in a black denim jacket and camouflage pants, coming up the path, out of the dark, in long strides. "Hey, Twinkle Toes," he said, "let's dance." "I already did." He bumped his fist on the top of her head, grabbed her school backpack by one strap. She had the other one and didn't let go, so he towed her along after him into the darkness, which smelled of grass and sun-warmed asphalt and, distantly, the sea. "Where's Mom?" Aisha asked.
"At work."
"Why is she at work?"
"She's supposed to get off at 4.
"Dunno. 'Cause Dick Clark hates black people, I guess," he said. Her mother worked the grill at a Dick Clark's bandstand restaurant, an hour-long bus ride south in Daytona Beach. On the weekends, she vacuumed at the Hilton Bayfront in St. Augustine, an hour's bus ride north.
"How come Dad didn't pick me up?"
"He's cleaning up after the drunks tonight." Her father was an orderly at a blue-collar rehab facility for alcoholics. Work that combined the pleasures of janitorial labor, there was always puke to mop up, with the invigorating effort of wrestling hysterical junkies in the throes of withdrawal. He often came home with bite marks on his arms. Coulson lived with Aisha's father and Aisha's stepmother, Paula. Coulson's mother was Paula's sister, but Paula's sister couldn't look after herself, let alone anyone else. Why she couldn't look after herself had never been adequately explained to Aisha, and in truth she didn't much care. If Coulson Withers had a Coca-Cola and she wanted a sip, he let her have one no hesitation. If they were out where there was a video game and he had a quarter in his pocket, it was hers. And if he didn't listen to her when she told a long rambling story about the stupid things Cheryl Portis said in dance class, he also never told her to shut up. They trotted along Copper Street to Mission Avenue. The east-west streets in that part of town were all colors, copper, gold, rose. There was no blue street, and there was no black street,